I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax News, an emergency episode on Jeffrey Epstein, the wealthy sex offender whose sordid saga has taken the nation by storm, especially in light of his apparent suicide. Joining us on this edition of the show is New York-based journalist Marlon Ettinger, who actually was covering the court case. He was at the courthouse in New York before this all went down with the apparent suicide of Jeffrey Epstein. Marlon joins us to discuss not only Epstein's death, but also the 800-plus pages of documents that have been unsealed in relation to Epstein from the Virginia Roberts versus Ghislaine Maxwell case. Maxwell, of course, serving basically as Epstein's pimp, to be blunt. And Roberts, one of his victims. Also, Marlon tells us a little bit about covering the court case. He was around the courthouse. He had some experiences with, Mike Cernovich, who was involved in this whole deal, this sort of right-wing propaganda journalist trying to take credit for a lot of the exposure of Epstein, and also Conchita Sarnoff, who wrote one of the first books on Epstein, Human Trafficking. You know, I just want to get right into it. I need to release this episode as quickly as possible. My apologies for being so out of breath. It was a long weekend, and I'm still sifting through a lot of different things, talking to a lot of different people about the Epstein case off air. And I'm just really anxious to get this out there. And just so everyone knows, the conversation is very minimally edited compared to other episodes. Everything is clear. You can understand everything that's going on, so that shouldn't be a problem. There may be some background noise here or there, but it's really not anything, to be honest. With that being said, my conversation with Marlon Ettinger, New York-based journalist who has been covering the Jeffrey Epstein case. Welcome to Parallax Views, Marlon Ettinger.
Hey, JG, how's it going?
Pretty good, pretty good. So I wanted to have you on because you were covering the court case of Jeffrey Epstein in New York, but now, as we know, Mr. Epstein is dead.
Yeah, and so's the court case, probably. It's interesting when the defendant dies, isn't it? It wraps up the case. It makes it difficult to know where the case is going to go. It was a shock to me. What about you?
Well, like everyone else who's been covering the case in any significant way within independent media, it was just sort of like waking up to an atomic bomb being dropped on us.
Yeah, I mean, I say it's a shock. It's not like an intellectual shock. I mean, I remember, you know, you saying to everyone, oh yeah, they're going to kill him, they're going to kill him. But then when it actually happens, and I don't, I guess that's the other question. The suicide story, just, I don't buy it for a second.
What don't you buy about it? Do you think he was, like, murdered, or do you think, you know, guards got paid off to look the other way? I've heard a lot of different things, from negligence to conspiracy.
Yeah, I'm talking sort of instinctually. I just, and, you know, there's all these reports in the press that, like, people post them are shocked that he killed himself. I mean, but that always happens, unfortunately, when someone, or often happens when someone commits suicide. They never really know. People around them, they say, oh, they were so happy, this and that. And I'm going to talk in the same anecdotal way. I just remember in the last court appearance at the end of last month, there was some confusion over scheduling. And I just remember seeing him in the courtroom laughing along with the lawyers at that mistake. So that, for me personally, the fact that he killed himself, it's of course plausible. People kill themselves, even when they seem happy. But it seems so jarring with that context, the idea that he would kill himself.
Go ahead.
And on the merits, you know, there's a ton of suspicious stuff. It just came out, supposedly his cellmate was removed right before he was taken off suicide watch 2 days before. I think the thing about there being no video footage that's going around, I think that's a rumor. I don't know if that's true, but also I wouldn't be surprised. It just sticks to high heaven.
Yeah, the latest thing I found was the New York Post is interviewing Louis Kasman, who is a former John Gotti associate. Huh. And apparently Kasman was saying, you know, he doesn't see how Epstein could have committed suicide without help.
There was another story in the Post that was published anonymously, and I don't know if you saw the title. It was former MCC inmate. There's no way Jeffrey Epstein killed himself. And
I did see that.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's funny to read from. He says, how did he hang himself? He said, this guy wrote, you know, you have sheets, but they're paper level, not strong enough. Yeah. He says, could he have done it from the bed? No, sir. There's a steel frame, but you can't move it. There's no light fixture. There's no bars. All your pens are rubber, and you only get one piece of paper a week. Nothing hard or made of metal. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm noticing, too, that there's a lot of talk over what happens now with the criminal case. I'm seeing articles in Slate. Slate released an article that said, Epstein accusers say quest for justice far from over following suicide. But then I'm seeing other stories that are saying this could be the end of it. So there's a lot of conflicting takes.
Yeah, well, I guess the one thing we know is that the Southern District of New York put out Berman, who's the attorney, that they put out a press statement saying that they were going to continue pursuing the justice. Mm-hmm. Who that means, who they're going to prosecute, what that means, they didn't specify, but there is that.
Well, it was a conspiracy case, right?
There was a conspiracy to commit sex trafficking. Mm-hmm. So there are, by definition, the government says there are other people involved. So there is that.
Mm-hmm. What about MCC? Like, assuming it was a suicide, will they face any repercussions for this?
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, Ben Sasse, that senator, put out a thing saying there needs to be accountability. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be an inspector general investigation. I know William Barr announced that.
Ocasio-Cortez, I think, was basically saying the same thing. I think a lot of people spun that as her saying there was a conspiracy. Although I have heard, you know, Paul Krugman.
Yeah.
Krugman is saying that he thinks it's a conspiracy. I never thought I'd see the day, to be honest.
A lot of people, you know, I mentioned it. There's
Michael Moore, a bunch of people, yeah.
It's one of those things where Usually with a conspiracy, the idea that you believe there's a conspiracy makes you a nut. In this case, it's the idea that you don't believe there's a conspiracy makes you a nut, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I myself am open to saying that it was just a horrible negligence, like, of a criminal level, or that, you know, a guard got paid to, you know, step away maybe for a bit longer than necessary. But I think either way, it's pretty bad. I mean, if he's a very high profile, you know, prisoner. So if he was murdered, you know, that indicts our institutions. If he did commit suicide, that indicts the institutions. And the fact that we don't know is an indictment itself. I mean, you can't even trust anything that's going on anymore with this.
No, not at all. And especially because it comes in the context of, and I guess this is a good segue to that, those documents that came out just right before, 2 days before it happened. Mm-hmm. There was this feeling that that there was going to start to be some questions answered and that some pieces were going to start to be put together. But then he dies and that feeling has sort of disappeared, I think.
Yeah, you know, before we get into the documents, the only other two things I wanted to hit on were, first, was he or was he not on suicide watch? I believe he wasn't. That's the reports I'm seeing now.
Yeah, it's been reported that he was, but I haven't heard that from the Bureau of Prisons or any official source, right?
Yeah, because it's just insane the number of just conflicting sources that are coming out. And now even a lot of like fake sources. There was this thing called BNL Live, Breaking News Live.
Right. Yeah.
That was completely it was a one man operation that was just taking stuff from Twitter and Facebook. So there's so much misinformation. The other thing I heard was that Epstein was despondent. He was like eating food off the ground. He was requesting like massive amounts of toilet paper. He was acting very strange. I've heard that. I've also heard that it doesn't. I've heard conflicting reports on that too, though.
Yeah, I've heard the same. You know, there was some Washington Post reporter who said something like his friends were surprised because he seemed to be upbeat. His lawyers said that he was upbeat, and just I mean anecdotally. From the courtroom the last time, which was I think the 31st.
You were there, yeah.
Yeah, he didn't seem, and obviously that, you know, mental health doesn't work that way, but he at least didn't, he did not seem despondent. He laughed, he seemed comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if he has it's interesting you talk about him eating a lot of food because there was some report.
Well, eating food off the ground, which is like really weird.
Oh, right. That's different, yeah. There was some report at the end of July when there was another supposed suicide attempt.
Was that a suicide attempt though, or was it an assault? I've read that it's an assault.
Well, yeah, that's sort of unwitting. He had a cellmate called Nicholas Tartiglione, some Italian name I can't pronounce.
I've also seen reports saying that the guards were laughing about that.
When he was unconscious. I think Radar Online reported that. But when that happened, so there was all these reports, and supposedly his cellmate was questioned about the assault, and his lawyer came out with a statement, this interesting statement. When I say his, I mean this guy Nicholas Tartiglione's, saying that him and Epstein were actually getting on very well, but they'd been complaining about food and conditions and rats. So just the idea of him getting on well with this guy Nicholas strikes me as a little entertaining. Nicholas is that guy, he's being prosecuted for killing a bunch of drug dealers and burying them in his backyard.
Whoa.
yeah, which is also interesting. And this is more speculation than anything, but, you know, the government was seeking the death penalty against that guy.
Wow.
So who knows what he would have done to get to, you know, shake the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
Though it was recently reported, I think it was in New York Magazine that his roommate had just been, he had been moved away from his roommate right before he killed himself or he died.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very tangled web. In regards to the conspiracy theories that are arising, I have a pretty complex take on it because, like I said, you know, we're at a point where I don't think we can trust our institutions in this country. I've really been trying to hammer that home to people. I'm like, I think from Watergate to Iran-Contra and then, you know, the Iraq War, the 08 financial crisis, and then Trump winning the election when everyone thought that was impossible, apparently. I think just no one trusts the institutions anymore. So I understand why people have jumped on the conspiracy sort of train with this one. And it does, it just feels like something out of like The Godfather Part 2, you know, but what do you make of the conspiracy theories so far in this whole tit for tat? There's now hashtags going around. There was the Clinton body count hashtag. And in order to counteract that, people are now making a Trump body count hashtag. It all seems a little over the top for me and kind of tabloidy.
It definitely is. And it's just very funny to me, you know, that when a guy dies in a federal prison, the immediate thing is to speculate that it was not the current president, but the former president.
Whatever. You mean the one that couldn't win an election against a third-rate reality TV star who everyone in New York hated anyways?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. What happened to conspiracy theories? You know, nowadays you're not even accusing the current president. You're going back. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially with all the connections between Trump and that case, it's just weird and stupid. That's not a very artful way to put it, but.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also the whole like, oh, he's not really dead thing going around. I mean, it's getting really, really out there, and a lot of it, I think, is like sort of this post-irony stuff that people on social media do, but I think it's actually doing a lot of damage.
I think, yeah, I haven't seen it done ironically. Maybe I don't have a good enough detector, but I think a lot of people believe it, and they just find it plausible. Yeah, it was funny. You see some, like, mainstream sort of Democrat resistance types posting that the body is faked and stuff, you know?
I saw George Takei say, he was talking about, this is about rich and powerful men, and it's beginning to feel like we live in Russia. And I just thought to myself,
right.
Like, I get the rich and powerful men thing. I get the gender stuff that people want to talk about. But I also feel like that ignores Ghislaine Maxwell's role in this whole thing, which apparently is shocking people. How could a woman do this? I think that's like a very Victorian way to view gender, though. And the other thing was, like, this whole, like, Russia thing. Like, I don't understand the politicizing of it. Like, this is really bad for, you know, just the elites in general, I think.
Yeah.
Or would have been. I don't know now.
Exactly. I think the Russia thing comes from this logic. You know, everything bad about our country cannot be homegrown. It has to be imported. It's foreign influence, everything that's bad.
Well, otherwise, we're living in a banana republic.
Oh yeah, and we wouldn't want to be a banana republic like one of those other countries. It's as if corruption and, you know, malfeasance are foreign imports. Mm-hmm. That's where it comes from.
Well, it reminds me of you know, people always tell me that if Trump wins in 2020, I'm moving out of the country. I'm going to Canada. And I always say to them, I'm like, it's interesting you always say Canada or like Sweden. It's all like white people territory. You never say like Mexico. You never say like South America. It's always like, I mean, this is what liberals do a lot of times. I don't know. I'm very distrustful of libs, though, I guess.
Well, you should be, you know, because Canada is not great politically either. Mm-hmm. So.
And I guess too, he didn't die in prison, right? Because people are saying that too, that he died in prison. He was taken to a hospital. I think he had a cardiac arrest.
He was found unresponsive in prison. There was one person that reported at 3:30 a.m. and another reported at 7:30 a.m. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things that's unconfirmed still. Mm-hmm. But they were trying to revive him, I guess. There's those pictures.
He was taken to a hospital, yeah.
He was taken to downtown Presbyterian, I think, in Manhattan. So he was definitely taken to a hospital.
Okay. Now that we have all the facts cleared up on the death, because we had to do that, we should probably talk about what probably actually matters, which is the unsealing of these, you know, documents. People are calling them the Epstein files. Well, now they're not even talking about them, but they're probably worth talking about.
Yeah, definitely. There's so many of them right now. There's like some over 800 that what I've been doing with them is I've just been, you know, flitting through them. You know, you search a couple of names, you see what comes up. Mm-hmm. And something that, an angle that I'm really interested in with Epstein, mostly because it just hasn't been reported very much, is Paris and France.
Well, what he was real doing. Quick, this is, what case is this? This is Guifieri.
Oh, yeah.
It was one of the girls that accused Epstein and others of stuff. And Ghislaine Maxwell, right? I want to make my listeners understand very clearly what case this is dealing with.
Yeah, and that was a defamation case. So, you know, Ghislaine Maxwell, Virginia Guifieri had said some things about her in another case, and Ghislaine Maxwell had denied, and her agents sort of had denied them out in the press. So Virginia Guifieri sued her for defamation, saying that all this stuff is true, and he's saying that it's false, mm-hmm. is wrong. Mm-hmm. And that case has been going on since 2015, and just the other month, they ruled to unseal a bunch of the court documents that had been sealed by the previous person who handled the case, because cases often go through many judges.
So this is completely unrelated to Epstein and why he got arrested. These
exactly.
are two separate things. Okay.
No connection. And in fact, you know, when I first went to the courthouse, I asked people like David Boies and Bradley Edwards, and they, who are two attorneys who've been involved in representing one of the victims, and they, you know, confirmed that in their opinion. It had nothing to do with it. And, you know, it has nothing to do with it simply because of this. The documents were still sealed when the USA versus Epstein case began. So they hadn't even been released.
Now, real quick, so with the unsealing, I want to understand who was wanting what in that case. Maxwell, I believe, didn't want them unsealed. Dershowitz did want some of them unsealed. And then Guifieri, I don't know. Did she want them unsealed?
Well, yeah. So that's dependent on the timeline. Mm-hmm. Initially, Guifieri and her lawyers did not want some of the documents unsealed because they argued it would have prejudiced jury selection. And those were the documents that Dershowitz wanted unsealed. But here's how it works. So it's civil litigation. So the way Dershowitz inserted himself in the case was as a legal intervener. So that means he's not really a party to the case, but he has an interest in information that comes out in the judicial process. So he requested, what he really wanted were these emails between a journalist called Sharon Churcher and Guifieri. And he claimed that it was to exonerate him. And these emails were, I think they met in Australia, Guifieri and Churcher, and they became very friendly. And, you know, Churcher wrote some stories about her in the mail on Sunday. And Dershowitz claimed that, you know, Guifieri was just named him on the suggestion of Churcher. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole other little side plot, but I'll stick to just this case. Mm-hmm. And he did that in 2016, one of those documents, and they were denied. And then in early 2017, Mike Cernovich also joined as a legal intervener and wanted to unseal the summary judgment, which had those emails in it, and Dershowitz joined that motion.
And for my listeners that don't know, Mike Cernovich is sort of this I don't even know how to describe him. He went from like being like some weird like pro rape men's rights activist Gamergate guy to like, you know, jumping on this bandwagon ever since that documentary Open Secret came out, saying that he's like going to expose the Hollywood pedophile elites. So that, for my listeners, he's sort of a right wing sort of quote unquote journalist.
Yeah. And, you know, as the court argued in this case, journalism is an act, not a profession. So they had to grant him the right to intervene. But I want to be clear about what legal intervention is. It's, you're not party to the case. You don't have any special privileges in the case. What it means is that you have an interest in some of the information from it. Mm-hmm. So even though people like Dershowitz and Cernovich are on the court documents, mm-hmm. it doesn't give them any imprimatur of mm-hmm. of the court. Mm-hmm. Because it was actually neither of them that got the records unsealed. It was the Miami Herald, which, you know, made their own motion to unseal the entire docket.
And that's important because Cernovich has been taking credit for, I'm the reason that, they went after Epstein. I'm the reason the documents are getting unsealed. He's been patting himself on the back a lot.
Right. And it's explicitly wrong. And I actually want to read you something from the judgment just the other day that came out on the decision to unseal. They say specifically about why they unsealed. Mm-hmm. Our discussion here focuses specifically on the district court's denial of the Herald's motion to unseal the entire record. Mm-hmm. So nobody else had any role in unsealing the documents, mm-hmm. according to the court. They didn't take into consideration anyone else's motion. Mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So initially, Ruffieri didn't want these documents to come out because, as Paul Cassell said in court, her lawyer, it might prejudice jury selection. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, after the case concluded, they've been in favor of unsealing the entire docket. Mm-hmm. Okay. And a little note on Cernovich. Ruffieri's lawyers hate him. Mm-hmm. They've said in court, I would like to get the quotes here because they're very well phrased. They didn't want him to be able to legally intervene because mm-hmm. of what he believes and this and that. And the court, of course, said that he had a right to intervene because it's a First Amendment issue. It doesn't matter the character of the person. Anyone can do it. Mm-hmm. Where are my quotes here? Oh, I think I got them right here. Okay. Paul Cassell, Ruffieri's lawyer, said this about Cernovich. We would also describe him as a proxy or a stand-in for Mr. Dershowitz. He went on to say, that he showed up just after Dershowitz couldn't get the documents mm-hmm. and called him a cat's paw for Alan Dershowitz.
And so, I think Cernovich has denied that, right?
Yeah, which makes no sense to me. I mean, of course they'll deny it, but yeah.
I mean, he had Dershowitz in one of his, documentaries and whatnot. They knew each other, so yeah.
Oh, no, definitely. I believe that 100%. Mm-hmm. And I think they knew each other through some lawyer as well. That's how they mm-hmm. got him in that documentary. Mm-hmm. But that's that. And so that brings us to today, where a bunch of the documents have been unsealed. Not all of them yet, because they're still going through mm-hmm. a redaction process, but 833 pages, mm-hmm. which are just an avalanche of information. Mm-hmm. And so what I picked out of it so far, because as I was saying, I'm interested in Paris and France and that side of the Epstein case, mostly because it hasn't been reported much. And I don't know a lot about it, but I'm just interested in knowing more. There's a few references to France. Mm-hmm. Ruffieri mentions that in 2001 she took a trip with him to France, that she stayed in a hotel over the Champs-Élysées, that she went to to Naomi Campbell's birthday party in 2001. And she mentions, that Naomi Campbell was kind of a bitch to her.
Yeah, that was the exact wording.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas, she said she was friends with Ghislaine, but called her a bitch. Yeah. That's all there is about France, unfortunately, so far.
And that's where Epstein came back from right before he got arrested.
Yeah, he flew in from Paris. He was on his vacation there. He has a house on Avenue Foch, which is right off the Champs-Élysées, and it's, Avenue Foch is one of the most wealthy neighborhoods in Paris and probably the world. And I found out, actually, I'd walked past his house once. I mm-hmm. spent some time in Paris, and I didn't know it was his house at the time, but I looked it up later.
What the fuck is this guy, the international man of mystery?
Oh, yeah, I mean, all sorts of, but, Ruffieri mentions in that same trip, they flew to Tangier and Morocco, they mm-hmm. flew to France, they flew to Thailand. That's how Ruffieri eventually got away from him. Mm-hmm. He sent her to Thailand to, get another girl for him. And from there, she ran away to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And in Australia, that comes back to Sharon Churcher. It's actually those emails that Dershowitz claimed would exonerate him, I think those were some that came out in the Dufthus Emil mails between her and Churcher. And there's one where Churcher mentions...
Who is Churcher for my listeners that may be unfamiliar?
Yeah, Sharon Churcher is that journalist I mentioned earlier who worked for the Mail on Sunday, and she was the sort of first one who Fury talked to tell her story about the abuse. So Churcher says something in her email like, you know, oh, we've all believed that Dershowitz is a pedo. Did you ever see him with Epstein? And Dershowitz claims that that exonerates him. He hasn't come out and said anything yet, but I think that's the email he's talking about, which really doesn't exonerate him at all in my mind. Mm-hmm. All it says is, it's not her saying you should name Dershowitz. It's her saying, have you heard anything about Dershowitz? Mm-hmm. Those emails are interesting, though, because they had a very friendly relationship, Churcher and Guiffieri. And it's cool to read them. You know, she's excited to talk and tell her story. It's kind of nice to read those and see her doing that. Another thing that jumped out to me from those documents was a police report from Palm Beach where Dershowitz was basically trying to discredit. This was when he was on the legal team. So Alan Dershowitz was also on Jeffrey Epstein's original legal defense team back in 2006. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to discredit the victims by sending the police department their MySpace profiles. And yeah, you have to read it. It's very funny. Mm-hmm. The officer talks about what Dershowitz sent him. I reviewed the profiles Mr. Dershowitz enclosed. Blank, who designed her blog to be blank, fucking, blank, still attends blank high school, sends and receives messages from friends which contain some profanity. Upon reviewing her friends' comment section from MySpace, most of her good friends sent messages to establish contact and invite her to go out. I then reviewed Blank's web blog, which was provided by Mr. Dershowitz. Miss Blank designed her blog to be, quote, blank. Her blog states that her interests include music, theater, and weed, parentheses, marijuana. I reviewed her packet in which Blank declares her love for her live-in boyfriend. She also describes using marijuana with her boyfriend. Mm-hmm. So this is Dershowitz basically trying to, discredit the character of a bunch of the victims in that original case through, these very scandalous behaviors like smoking marijuana and using profanity.
He sounds like an old school conservative.
I mean, definitely, and a scumbag lawyer.
That goes without saying. I mean, this is a dude. Yeah. I want to say it real quick because this pisses me off. People always talk about, well, Dershowitz was he's a Harvard professor, and I'm Harvard hired him because he was a celebrity. Harvard does stuff like that. The reason he's a celebrity is he was third, fourth, fifth string on the OJ case. I mean, this is not exactly the most, I think he's always been kind of, on the lower end of things.
Yeah. I mean, he also, I think, gets a lot of play because he's willing to go on TV and defend stuff that a lot of people won't defend or write publicly. Mm-hmm. You know, the first mention I heard of him was sort of the controversy between him and Norman Finkelstein, where, about Israel. You know, he wrote this book called Chutzpah, Dershowitz Defending Israel, and Norman Finkelstein wrote a reply called Beyond Chutzpah in reply of his entire book. And then he plagiarized a lot of stuff in that book, mm-hmm. Dershowitz, and Finkelstein confronted him on a radio interview and went through it all. But it's not and that speaks to the respectability point, which is what the Harvard cachet is supposed to signify. Mm-hmm. That because he's a Harvard professor, he is entitled to a certain amount of credibility and respect. But he's just a scumbag lawyer. He has no ethics. He's probably, allegedly, a pedophile. He completely, unhinged level of pro-Israel, pro-right-wing Likud supporter.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask real quick, too. He also, may have played a role in Finkelstein having academic troubles at one point, as I understand it.
Yeah, I've heard that, but I don't know anything really specifically. I know he couldn't find a job anywhere in the United States. And right. He had to end up like teaching at the American University in Cairo at some point. And
well, all the academics I've talked to, their take on it was that you know, Finkelstein is like highly polemical.
Yes.
But he's fairly good academically. He does cite and he does do his like due diligence in terms of research, and he was pointing out real plagiarism on the part of Dershowitz. What do you think is gonna become of Dershowitz now with all of this? I'm assuming this is the end of the line for him. His reputation is permanently just ruined.
Well, yeah, his reputation definitely is ruined. I don't know. Maybe he'll try to keep spinning it. There's actually another case. Guiffieri also sued him for defamation this year. So that case is going through everything. And he is up to his old tricks, you know, trying to discredit all the witnesses, discredit Guiffieri. But I don't see how he has any way to do it. Mm-hmm. It's just so comprehensive, the evidence.
Is Guiffieri the one that has accused him of rape? Or was it another?
Oh, yeah. Guiffieri has accused him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but also someone called Sarah Mansone. Mm-hmm. I think I have some notes on that. Yeah, Guiffieri versus Dershowitz. Yeah, so basically Dershowitz claims that Roberts basically hatched a plot to accuse him of sex trafficking as part of a criminal attempt to extort a settlement from him. You know? He said, like, he wrote in the Harvard Crimson. This was just last year, December 5th. Mm-hmm. You know, he wrote in the Harvard Crimson, "Not only did Virginia Roberts lie about me, she lied about Alan Tipper Gore and President Bill Clinton, claiming she met the three of them on Jeffrey Epstein's island, a claim refuted by Secret Service records that has ever said none of them were on that island during that period of time." And he's done this all over the press, defending himself. So eventually, Guiffieri sued him. In fact, in March 2nd, yeah, I'll read this. March 2nd, Dershowitz challenged Ransome. Ransome is Sarah Ransome, who's another woman who has claims that she was abused, and Roberts to sue him for defamation. And then they did. So, because he never, you know, he thought that that was going to exonerate him. Mm-hmm. Or that they, oh, if you're going to make these claims, sue me for defamation. Mm-hmm. Well, they did sue him for defamation. And that case is now going through the courts.
I'm just imagining, I shouldn't be making light of this, but I'm imagining Norman Finkelstein. There's a famous clip of Norman Finkelstein where he yells at a girl who's offended by his work, and he says, "Crocodile tears! Crocodile tears!"
Yeah, I know.
And I'm just imagining Dershowitz like crying over this, and Finkelstein just being like, "Crocodile tears!"
Yeah. Man.
So he's basically, you know, probably screwed, hopefully. As for Guiffieri, I always mispronounce her name. I feel bad for that. I should just say Virginia Roberts, but...
You can just say Virginia.
right? But, there was some people saying that, like, these unsealed documents, especially people on Team Dershowitz, they were saying, like, you know, oh, this isn't going to, like, bode well for her. How do these documents reflect on her so far? Other than her calling Naomi Campbell a bitch.
They reflect pretty well on her. You know, they show attempts to correct the record where it's wrong. There's one deposition where she talks about, she's being asked about the Churcher reporting. And there's some stuff that she says that Sharon Churcher got wrong. And she goes through all of it and corrects it where it's wrong and confirms it where it isn't. Mm-hmm. So I haven't read through all of everything so far, but so far I think it reflects well on her. And I mentioned those emails between her and Churcher. It's sort of more like of a personal aspect of the case that to see that relationship between them, where she's finally telling her story and she has this person who she met and she's becoming friendly with and opening up to her. It's kind of touching, you know, to see that or go through that. And mm-hmm. So I haven't seen anything that reflects poorly on her so far.
Are there any things?
Not even ethically, you know?
What's that?
Not even ethically. I haven't seen anything that reflects Boilander so far.
Are there any things that, like, can be definitively corroborated with regards to Geoffrey from the unsealed documents? Like, do things generally line up? Anything specifically that may line up with what we know that we can sort of corroborate?
Well, we know now that she testified under oath that she saw Bill Clinton with Jeffrey Epstein.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually, you know, there's in some of the Daily Mail reporting, or I think it's actually the Mail on Sunday, that Churchill published, she said stuff like, Bill Clinton said we had, you know, she was good, which Geoffrey confirms that that never happened. Oh, here it is now. See, also we can confirm that Donald Trump was good friends with Jeffrey Epstein at that time. She confirms that, and she says that even, she says she never saw them together, but that Epstein would mention him often and say that they were good friends.
Mm-hmm. At what time was this around?
Let's see. This was probably around 2001, 2002.
Okay.
That time frame. And then there's a bunch of other people she names having seen. She names having seen Owl and Tipper Gore.
Mm-hmm.
Not just seeing them on the island. And Heidi Klum, Naomi Campbell,
mm-hmm.
people like that.
Okay. So there's all kinds of people. We have models. We have, you know, politicians. Yeah.
And the other thing was supposedly there was a – I don't know if you've heard of this hammock picture.
Mm-hmm.
Supposedly there's this picture that Virginia gave to him. It's a nude picture of her in a hammock
mm-hmm.
of when she was underage. And he would always have it on his desk and mm-hmm. in the house. So basically what she was saying, that anyone who came and met him in his office would have seen that picture.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, if you go through all the people that met him in his office, according to her, like, Bill Clinton had taken meetings in that office with him. So she said, oh, he must have seen that picture.
Mm-hmm.
Those are things that are confirmed.
So in a lot of ways, it sounds like a lot of this humanizes her.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, so far it seems like, especially with the British coverage, Geoffrey has just sort of, like, captured the British interest because of the Prince Andrew stuff. And I haven't seen that human side discussed as much.
Yeah. Well, naturally, these documents, because they're from the Geoffrey versus Maxwell case, it's going to include a lot of stuff about Geoffrey. So that's why so much stuff is coming out personally with her.
Mm-hmm.
And not so much, you know, with other victims who've talked about it.
Do you think she was closer to Epstein than the other victims, or no?
Huh. That's a good question. I don't know. I think she probably thought she was, as,
mm-hmm.
You know, that's what happens to a lot of victims. But
that's,
I mean,
very
she,
true. Yeah.
Yeah, she was his live-in girlfriend for years.
Mm-hmm.
So they definitely had a relationship of sorts, mm-hmm. you know, an abusive criminal relationship. But and he would talk to her about, you know, like, oh, my friend Donald Trump and all this stuff. So I couldn't answer that, really. I haven't heard enough from the other victims about what their relationships were like.
Well, are there any tidbits that are worth discussing in regards to the documents as they pertain to Maxwell? Because right now, to me, the million-dollar question is, where in the world is Ghislaine Maxwell? Obviously, she's in the UK. She left New York when the heat started coming up with regards to Epstein. I think a lot of people are either shocked by Maxwell's involvement in the Epstein case because she's really culpable in it. And I think a lot of people just don't want to talk about that aspect at times because it's really I think it flies in the face of how we think gender roles work at times.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, Ghislaine Maxwell is more than culpable in it. She hasn't just been accused of, you know, setting it up and helping it out.
She's been engaged in the abuse as well, right?
Exactly. I'm trying to find the name. There was this one woman who claimed she was assaulted by Maxwell and Epstein in Leslie Wexner's house in Ohio. She used to be his door guard, or sort of receptionist. And she, you know, specifically says that they assaulted me and I reported it to the FBI and they, no follow-up, of course. But that's just one person. You know, many, there have been many similar accusations against her. As far as the files, I actually haven't really looked through the files yet for anything think about Maxwell. I've been looking for the Grafiri stuff. There's definitely stuff about Maxwell in those files. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I have not looked through that side of it yet.
Well, okay, so not necessarily with these files, but just in general, what do you make of the whole Trump angle? Because, you know, I know people like Sam Spadino, who actually, like, you know, basically heckled Trump about Epstein, I think during the 2016 election. He's, like, a firm believer in the Trump-Epstein angle. Now other people are saying, like, well, Trump said that he broke it off with Epstein, you know, in the 2000s, and they had a very, very bad falling out, and I've heard that it was about financial stuff. What do you just make of the Epstein-Trump sort of relationship?
Yeah, it seems they were definitely friends for a long time. Mm-hmm. There's that. That's the thing to start with. And they were friends in the 90s, which was when they were mostly in New York. Mm-hmm. In Michael Wolff's book, who wrote Fire and Fury, well, in Fire and Fury, they even mentioned that it was Trump, Epstein, and Tom Barrack Jr., who was another billionaire, who they were like the Three Musketeers. That's what everyone would say. They would always go out and party together all the time, this and that. Mm-hmm. As for the falling out, here's what I have to say about that. Donald Trump is not somebody who is shy about saying what he thinks of people, is he? Mm-hmm. When have you ever heard him bad-mouthing Jeffrey Epstein?
Well, up until recently, right?
Exactly. But if they had some falling out, you know, why wouldn't he have leaked to some newspaper, oh, Epstein's an asshole, this and that?
Well, he's a very petty guy. I mean, I think exactly. Are you familiar with the Durst real estate family?
Is that the same Durst who murdered the guy? His wife?
Yeah. So when that started coming out about Robert Durst, Robert, I think, was becoming less and less involved in the family's real estate stuff. But Trump was in competition with the real estate family, right? So basically in competition with Robert Durst's brother. Mm-hmm. And he started defending Robert Durst because he hated the Durst family so much because, you know, Robert Durst and the brother don't get along. So he was defending Robert Durst.
Exactly.
Because he hated this real estate family so much.
I mean, yeah, and I think that sums up. I think it's very weird that if they had this falling out that you never heard him badmouth Epstein ever until very recently, you know? Mm. You would think that he would go nuclear on him. So I think Pierce and I talked about that a little bit. I mean, they must have something on each other. There are, as far as, like, you know, evidence, there's all the standard stuff that Pierce Redmond has talked about. You know, there's records of them, of Epstein flying on Trump's plane. You know, there's that Golf magazine article where a reporter saw Ghislaine Maxwell, Donald Trump. Well, Donald Trump waiting for Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein to get on his plane, and they had some, you know, some young girls with them, women, girls. So there's that right there.
Well, we also have the whole Katie Johnson thing, right? And I think she said it was in Epstein's home in the 90s that she
in
was
Manhattan. Yeah.
Right, assaulted by Trump. Yeah.
Raped. Yeah, yeah. The both of them. She claimed they tied her to a bed and raped her. And that case didn't end up coming to trial because she said she got death threats.
Right. It was not thrown out as some disinformation and misinformation
exactly.
Types would say.
Mm-hmm. And it was Lisa Bloom, actually, who was her lawyer at that point, who has her own sort of stuff going on. But supposedly Gloria Allred, who's her mother, and another well-known like women's rights lawyer, Gloria Allred is supposedly representing some of her Epstein's accused or alleged victims now. She was at the courthouse. I think it was on the 31st, and she did a little press conference about it. She wouldn't say anything aside from that. She's representing them.
She's representing, she was representing Katie Johnson.
Lisa
Jane Doe.
Lisa Bloom was, and right. So now Gloria Allred, who's her mother, and is another sort of well-regarded lawyer, is representing some victims of Epstein.
Right, right. You know, I actually wanted to pick your brain about this, too. You were at the courthouse. What was that like? Because I think you can provide some insight. It seems like it would have been pretty crazy.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, the craziest part was just seeing him, you know, as a, you know, you read all this stuff and he is this terrible criminal. It seems almost unreal. And then you're there and you actually see him. He's a real person who did these things. And seeing some of the victims, you know, Courtney Wilde and Maria Farmer were there one, you know, early on. I think that was the second appearance, and they testified in court. It wasn't so much testimony. It was just against the bail release. They testified against the bail release, saying that he had abused them. And then outside of the courthouse, they're just, you're just waiting in line to get your laptop with these people.
What was the general feeling among other journalists that you may have talked to?
I heard from some people that, you know, the general feeling was that the case was an attempt to get Trump. Like, that was why the case was being brought, to get Trump. And I don't think that's necessarily true. I don't think it was just brought to get Trump. But that was something I heard from a bunch of people. Some Reuters producer actually told me that specifically.
Wow.
Because we were just, you know, you're just hanging out. There's a lot of just waiting around time.
I also know you've told me off air, there were two people in particular I wanted to talk about you had encounters with.
Of course.
If you don't want to talk about...
No, go ahead. I don't...
Okay.
the secret.
The first, I want to talk about your encounter with Mike Cernovich. Because I think my listeners would find that maybe an amusing little anecdote in a very dark fucking case, the sordid saga, so to speak.
Definitely. I think that was the first court appearance date. I was outside, like on Pearl Street. It wasn't on Pearl Street. It was on Worth Street. Your listeners don't care about this. This is just something people from New York do. They think it matters what street it is.
Hey, anyway. I got a lot of listeners in New York listening to this.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. And it was after Bradley Edwards came out with, I think it was Courtney Wilde, who was one of the victims, and there's the crush of journalists coming in. They're all following him off. So I'm sort of going in that way because I want to ask him about, you know, do you think this case has anything to do with the documents being unsealed? He said no. And but before that, I hear behind me, I'm not sure if it was him or one of his goons talking to a camera. You know, Jeffrey Epstein wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Mike Cernovich. I say I don't know if it was him because he speaks in the third person a lot. But I hear that and I turn around and it's him. And I just say, well, that's not true. And I started asking him, you know, why are you intervening for Dershowitz? What's your relationship with Dershowitz? This and that. And he won't give me a straight answer. He just he just says, oh, you know, I just want a big court case. Maybe you'll know what that's like someday. You're not important. I don't have to talk to you. This and that. He was very cowed. He's not a physically intimidating specimen at all. He had nothing to say because obviously he was helping out Dershowitz. And how do you reply to that? And, you know, he goes, oh, don't point your finger in my face. It was a very unremarkable encounter. He's a little shorter than me, just for the record. And he's He's a paper tiger. And that just went on, and then eventually he turned around and walked away, because I was trying to walk towards Edwards. So he just walked in the other direction.
Was it initially, like, confrontational? Or was he like, oh, nice to meet you, and then you sort of, you maybe pushed back on him a little bit?
Well, I initially, when I heard him say that, I said, that's not true. So it was probably a little confrontational.
Wait, so he said, nice to meet you, and you said, basically, like, no, it's not nice to meet you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he said, like, what's your name? Who are you with? So I shook his hand, and he said, nice to meet you. And I said, I can't say the same, you know. something like that.
He probably deserved that. I mean, he definitely deserved it.
He definitely deserved it. And then afterwards, he went on Periscope or something, and it was like, oh, I just got assaulted by this guy who's probably working for Epstein, blah, 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 blah. Assaulted, huh? Yeah.
I thought he was going to say, I got assaulted by Antifa.
Oh, Antifa. Yeah. He had nothing to say, and I think that's the main takeaway from it. It's a funny little anecdote, but the fact that he didn't try to defend what his relationship was with Dershowitz is almost confirmation of that. You know, he was just trying to help out Dershowitz in that case, as well as, you know, spin his whole angle that he's really the one who's winning all these legal victories. Because I think his whole thing really is that his message is, oh, everyone on the left is a pedophile. That's what he's trying to push.
Well, I mean, he's also just like the king of the grifters at this point.
Right, but it also has some political content. You know, he always goes, everyone on the left is a pedophile. That's his message, even if he doesn't say it. That's the message he's trying to put out there. And that's why he's adopted this sort of fake crusade. Because, of course, you know, what did he have to say about Roy Moore? What did he have to say, you know?
Yeah, it's funny that you said he was physically, like, unintimidating, because, like, when he was going through that MRA, like, men's rights activist, like, Gamergate phase, he was just like, I used to be a nice guy to woman. Now I'm an asshole, because that's what they really want. Ugh! And he's into this whole, like, guerrilla mindset thing. Like real, like, chest-poundy type shit. And I'm just like, hearing you describe him, it sounds like, you know, it's all a really pathetic kind of act.
Oh, yeah, well, that stuff is easy to do from behind a camera. You know, when someone is actually asking you to, you know, why, like, answer a fucking question, you know, and you got no answer, what are you going to do?
Well, I guess the other person I wanted to ask you about, because she's probably one of the more interesting people involved in the Epstein case, and I don't think we've ever talked about her on this show, is Conchita Sarnoff. Maybe you could give, like, a brief sort of sketch of who she is and how she fits into this.
Yeah, so Conchita Sarnoff is related to the case because she wrote a book called Trafficking. I believe the book came out in 2010.
Traffic Actually, King with an uppercase
guys,
K, yeah.
You guys get it? You guys get it? Yeah. I'll admit I actually have not read the book, but it was one of an early books about, you know, the whole Jeffrey Epstein case. And her perspective on it is interesting because she used to know Jeffrey Epstein. You know, she's this sort of high society type, I guess you could call her.
She's very bourgeois. She's traveled in the same circles. I've had multiple people tell me that, yeah.
Yeah, she's definitely. And she knew, like, Donald Trump. I think she knew Ghislaine Maxwell. So, yeah, that's who she is. And she's was at the courthouse a few times, like many journalists. You know, there were tons of, there was Vicky Ward was there, Michael Wolff. The first few appearances, everyone was there.
Julie K. Brown?
Julie K. Brown, yeah, yeah. I met her sort of, I guess, just very briefly. That was cool.
We'll get to that, but I want
to go. There's nothing to say about that. I was very brief. Just
okay,
like,
okay.
So Conchita Sarnoff, I talked to her a little, you know, and she's very dramatic, and, you know, I don't think she's that old, but she looks younger than she is. She has, you know, her hair still all blonde. She dresses, you know, in that way that you would if you were in a high society type, almost. And the second day, I'm standing in line waiting for the court, and I see her and, you know, say hello. And she sort of takes me out of the line and puts her, you know, takes me by the arm and whispers in my ear dramatically, you know. This is all about cover up. This is all about protection. That was the word she actually used, protection. That's what this case is about, protection. And then she swept away to wherever she was going, which was a funny moment because everyone on the line was then staring at me. What was that all about?
So you have people like Michael Wolff and like Vicky Ward just being like, "What the fuck?"
I think Michael Wolff was looking at me. I didn't see Ward. I hadn't talked. Because Michael Wolff probably knew that it sort of fits, I imagine. And yeah, I'm hoping to talk with you soon. Sorry, what was that?
You dropped out for a second. You were saying something about Michael Wolff.
Oh, I said, yeah, Michael Wolff probably knows who Sarnoff is, so he was probably interested in that. And I hope to talk to Conchita again, because she is in Europe now, I believe. I think she's doing some more, she's writing something about Epstein. And I'm very interested in this French angle. So we should talk soon. We've been playing phone tag.
Why are you interested so much in the French angle? I know, isn't there a different age of consent there?
I guess that's part of it. There is no age of consent in France, is the short answer. And they tried to get one recently, but I think it actually stalled in the National Assembly. Mm-hmm. They were going to bring it up to 15. There's still some like criminal penalties for like coerced or, you know, simple rape, as they call it. But there really is no age of consent law, so he will probably never. Oh, you know what's funny? I'm talking about him like he's alive. He's dead, so of course he's never going to get any. He never would have got any justice in France because of that.
It's still like sinking in, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah,
he's gone. Yeah.
Right there, as I was speaking about it, I was talking like he was alive. So that's one part of it. The other part is I'm gonna be in France this winter. I'm moving back there, so I'm gonna have the opportunity to follow up on some of this stuff. And then I guess the third is just there's not really reporting about it. I remember when I first got interested in it, I started going through Le Monde, which is the big French paper, and some like Le Parisien, which is the city paper there. And all the reporting on him is just, you know, rewrites of English language reporting. It's just reporting, which seems there have to have been things going on. You know, his victims talk about being flown to Paris. So that's why I have an interest in it.
Were there any other anecdotes you wanted to share about the court case? Or just being around the courthouse?
I saw Randy Credico. I don't think he was involved in the case. He was just around.
Everyone just showed up.
Everyone was there. Everyone was there.
Was it like overwhelming in a way? Was it tense? I mean, what was seeing Epstein like? I mean, that's like being in the presence of a monster, but he also seems like kind of a coward too.
Yeah, seeing him was very odd, as I've mentioned, mm-hmm. And he didn't seem that nervous the entire time. He would fidget a little with his hands. He would wear his glasses. He had, you know, little black tips at the end of his gray hair, the beginnings of a bald spot on the top. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say what it was like to see him. Now he's dead. That's the weirder part. He did seem very self-assured.
Mm-hmm. Which is odd, yeah.
Yeah. He seemed very self-assured. He did not seem concerned.
I guess the other thing I wanted to ask you about is, I guess with all this trafficking... I think looking into things like modeling agencies at this point would be really interesting. I know Les Wexner from, I guess, Victoria's Secrets factors into this. Did you see anything on him in the file so far, or anything on the Trump modeling agency?
Well, something I did see was, Jean-Luc Brunel. She was mentioned. He was mentioned. Who is this French guy who ran a modeling agency called, is it M2C or MC2? It's something like that. And it was well known, that he was sleeping with teenage girls, raping them. But because he was French and it was in France, there was not much done about it. Brunel. And I think Brunel, there's some anecdote floating around out there, and I keep telling myself I'm going to find the source. But when they were making MC2 models, they modeled it after like the Trump modeling agency. As for Wexner, there's not much about Wexner. There's a couple of things about it, more about the company. Because, I mean, there definitely is stuff like him visiting. That's mostly what it is. Wesley Wexner used to fly in to Palm Beach to visit him. But that's it. No big revelations about Wexner.
So before we wrap up, is there anything else you want to get out there with regards to what you've seen in the documents so far? Anything that really stood out?
I would actually, the boring answer is no, not yet. There's a lot of confirmation of stuff, but just and details, but nothing earth-shaking yet. I
Right, no
think
smoking gun necessarily.
exactly. I think this is this dump is 883 pages, but there's supposed to be 2,000 documents, and the rest of the documents have to go through a redaction process. And that process is they sit down, they have someone who sits down with each document and goes through it. So that's going to take a while. So there's still going to be a lot more coming out, but it'll take a while.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of research. I know Pierce Redmond is going through stuff now. A lot of people are. So I think this is in some ways far from over, despite Epstein's death. I don't know what your take on that is, though.
Yeah, it's far from over, but the death really does feel like it's going to make certain that a lot of the story isn't told. There's still a lot more story, but if he had testified, and if there had been that discovery process, there would have been a lot of stuff that would have come out. So I do think it is a blow against finding the truth or getting justice, for sure.
Well, I mean, there's so many different leads you could go on. I mean, you said there's the Paris connection, right? People have been telling me it would be beneficial probably to look into to talk to people in Ohio about it because of the Wexner stuff. I think he was also in New Mexico, right? Or Mexico, actually.
Oh, yeah, and there was some reporting recently about that, actually, in the Daily Beast, talking about how he donated to like Bill Richardson, and that was something that came out in the files too. Bill Richardson, who used to be the governor of Mexico, and I think had some position in the Trump, pardon me, not the Trump, in the Clinton administration, Commerce Secretary, I think. Yeah, he, and in fact, like locals would, say, oh, he would always fly in with girls, and there's some anecdote that they reported about. Some woman who worked in real estate came to his hotel room to get him to sign some papers, and there were and the person who opened the door was like a 14 or 15-year-old girl, and she at the time thought it was like his daughter or his niece, but probably not. And there were a few of them in the room.
Do you think this is bigger than just Epstein having, I hate to use this term because, and I use it mockingly, proclivities? Like, do you think there was actually a bigger, how deep do you think the rabbit hole goes? I know that's like a hot button, speculative question, but.
I think it goes super deep because there's also the royal family. Andrew, Prince Andrew, he's involved. There's just so many people involved. And who also, more importantly than involved, knew. Because, and so many people knew. That's what really is interesting about it to me.
It's like Jimmy Savile in Britain all over again.
Right. It wasn't just a lot of people were involved, but exponentially more knew about it. And I think there probably is some sort of political angle to it in that he was close to people in power. And I don't think it's necessarily so much a case of blackmail as he wanted to form these bonds with these people. You know, he was this poor Brooklyn kid, right, who somehow made his way into this sparkling world.
And he reminds me a lot of Jordan Belfort, the Wolf of Wall Street, because Jordan Belfort was sort of, I think he wasn't a WASP, and he always felt left out because he wasn't a WASP, like a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant kid, and he sort of, you know, sort of felt left out of his, like, peer group because of that, and, you know, there's a lot of speculation that that's what pushed Jordan Belfort, and I sort of can see that in Epstein, too. I think Epstein is actually a much more little man than we realize. I think he was driven by a lot of probably, I mean, I shouldn't psychoanalyze it, but he seems like a person that didn't come from he wasn't born into the elite, so to speak.
No, he wasn't, yeah.
Yeah.
And once he was there, I think he, you know, his whole interest in science, he was just, I doubt he had any genuine interest in science. He liked the cachet of being in like a funder of science. Because when you hear some of the theories that he talk about they're absurd, you know.
Eugenics, he funded money to the World Transhumanist Foundation or Association, I believe. So, yeah, a little wacky, I mean.
Yeah, it's not serious stuff. It's not like he has a serious interest in science. I think he liked the idea of hobnobbing with scientists and because that makes you smart and that makes you this and that. And then I guess a lot of those people liked the idea of hobnobbing with a billionaire.
Stephen Hawking, Stephen Jay Gould, which I'm actually sad about that because I like Stephen Jay Gould.
Is that true?
Yeah, that was, I believe, reported in the New York Times, yeah. I don't know if that means anything, but Stephen Jay Gould, Steven Pinker, yeah, all of those guys.
George Church, the biologist. George Church recently, like, apologized.
It was funny when they mentioned Stephen Jay Gould in the New York Times. They were, like, listing guys that he met after 2008, that scientists that Epstein met after 2008. And people like me and everyone else were like, Gould died in, like, 2002. How is that even possible? Like, I think he had met Epstein before, but it wasn't when a lot of the stories had broke about Epstein.
I see. Yeah. I don't have to read that because that would be a shame. Here's what it says. It says that Epstein hosted dinner parties and conferences at his various properties where he brought in big-time science luminaries. Some of those mentioned by the Times include Murray Gell-Mann, who won the Nobel Prize, Stephen Hawking, Stephen Jay Gould, Oliver Sacks, George Church, and Frank Wilczek, who won the Nobel. That's a shame. I like Gould myself. But like I said, I don't think he knew a lot about science. He wanted to freeze his penis, right? All this crazy stuff.
Cryogenics, the revenge of cryogenics. He wanted to be like Walt Disney. That's the urban legend goes.
Yeah.
I do think that aspect of the story is interesting, though. It sounds like he was interested in social Darwinism, like sort of a eugenics type deal.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was what his whole thing about breeding. He wanted to breed that crazy story.
Right.
He wanted to seed the human race with his gene pool, with his genes. You know what? I'm interested in if he ever actually did that to some degree. Yeah.
Well, I guess in closing, I'm seeing the reports now that, let me pull it up real quickly if I can.
What's it in relation to?
It's in relation to his death. First, okay, Jeffrey Epstein autopsy results expected to be released Sunday afternoon from New York Post.
Next Sunday.
Right. I think it was this Sunday, yeah. But I guess that hasn't happened yet unless we've missed something. Yeah. Also, from TMZ and the New York Post are both reporting Jeffrey Epstein's death likely not captured by cameras and guards didn't check on him.
Right.
That just, that blows my mind on every conceivable level. Because like I said, people want to focus on if he was murdered, and I'm like, if he wasn't murdered, a lot of people at MCC should be held accountable for this high-profile prisoner basically being able to kill himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. And in fact, I just, reading now, they did complete the autopsy, and here's what they have to say. Jeffrey Epstein's autopsy has been completed, according to city officials, but the medical examiner's office needs further information before determining a cause of death.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is far, like I said, far from over.
Far from over.
Do you think anything will happen with Maxwell? I mean, can the U.S. really get at her in any way?
Well, I mean, she's being sued, I don't know, criminally. They can do civil litigation against her. As Guafiri is doing.
I'm assuming there could be a lot more civil litigation with a lot of these characters.
I know that I always confuse Gloria Allred and Lisa Bloom, but one of them, who is representing some of her victims, wants and someone in charge of the state, the estate, to be designated as fast as possible so that civil litigation can go forward against the estate. And that's another thing, like the house was ordered to be confiscated, but now that the defendant is dead, they might not have standing to confiscate the house criminally. They could still confiscate it through, just because they can do that, but not through the criminal route.
Also, I just thought of it. What were your feelings? I'm sorry if I'm keeping you a little bit over, but what were your feelings on the attorneys representing the victims since you spoke with them?
I spoke very briefly, but I mean, Bradley Edwards is a, sort of like a movie star type. He looks like an attorney. He's got that pug nose and the slick back hair. He's very, very confident. David Boies is much more soft-spoken. David Boies has his own sort of stuff that he's been accused of, not himself of abusing anyone, but he was involved in Weinstein's defense at one point.
That's really weird.
Yeah, he was Weinstein's lawyer, and at the same time as he was the New York Times' lawyer, so there was stuff about a conflict of interest there that he shouldn't have done.
And Epstein himself was hobnobbing in Hollywood after everyone sort of knew what was going on. I think Vicki Ward has sort of alluded to that.
Yeah, I mean, there's pictures, and also just the film world, there's pictures of them in 2014 of Woody Allen hanging out with Jeffrey Epstein. They were supposedly quite friendly, actually. They were hanging out all the time. But yeah, boy, Bradley Edwards left a good impression. Sigrid McClally, who's done a lot of the civil litigation. It was interesting to put a face to all the names because you read the court files for so long and then you never, and then you actually see who they are. They all seem very confident. I don't know how they feel now.
Well, I'm assuming a lot of people are as pissed as AOC was in that tweet saying, this needs to be investigated,
Yeah, I agree. There should be hearings. It's a federal facility, so they can hold hearings. Oversight can do that. Which is, Cortez is a member of the House Oversight Committee, and Elijah Cummings is the chair. So that would be positive.
Well, I guess in closing, what do you want to leave listeners with in regards to, what maybe they should look into and also what they should probably be staying away from? Because the meltdown yesterday on social media was a spectacle in and of itself.
Yeah, I think if you have the time, it's worth reading the depositions in the Guafiri depositions, because it clears up a lot of stuff that's going around that is unclear, obviously. And also, There is a lot of, like you say, a lot of misinformation.
I was going to ask what's your take on the whole intelligence agency stuff. I know a lot of people are talking about DynCorp. I know a lot of people are talking about Mossad. I don't know what to think of all that.
I couldn't give an in-depth answer about that, but one thing I would say is the connection between Robert Maxwell, Ghislaine Maxwell, and Jeffrey Epstein doesn't strike me as credible because Epstein met Ghislaine Maxwell after Robert Maxwell died. That's why she moved to New York. Her father died, and she wanted to get away from it all. So,
well, it reeks of the whole conspiracy theory. I remember reading conspiracy theories saying that, you know, Monica Lewinsky was a Mossad agent, and you know, they went after Clinton because he was giving them problems with their nuclear arms stuff. And like, you can't really prove that, so we should probably stay away from stuff like that.
I think there could be connections. I think Whitney Webb at MinPress News has written some series about the connections between Mossad and him. So there could be. I haven't read those yet. It's just anyone who's, if you're talking about he has a connection because of Robert Maxwell, that's wrong because he met Ghislaine Maxwell after Robert Maxwell died. And it's all those sort of little details. And I guess on the other side, a lot of people say, oh, you know, William Barr's father, whose name is Donald Barr, hired Epstein at the Dalton School, and so now he's helping him out. But in fact, I don't think Donald Barr actually did hire Epstein. Donald Barr left in early 1972, and Epstein wasn't hired till September 1972.
You don't think Russia's behind it, right?
No, I don't think Russia's behind it. I'll go on the record with that. Russia is not behind it. With Gardner Dunnan, he's another interesting guy because he was accused of abusing students as well, Gardner Dunnan, the guy who hired Epstein. I mean, so I guess to wrap that up, the basic point is it's worth just looking into a little to every claim that people make because I think people are worried that if they do, it'll undermine their narrative, right? I say, oh man, if that's not true, then I guess there is no connection between Trump and Epstein, but there's still a lot of connection between Trump and Epstein. You know, Donald Barr didn't hire Epstein, but that doesn't mean that they weren't friends. And I think, sort of wrap that point up, the fact that Epstein was in this ruling class world is significant. He was in this circle because individual links are significant, but they're not always the only reason. Like, William Barr might protect Trump on the Epstein thing, not because his father hired Epstein, but because they're both rich people and powerful people. There's always going to be biography that links people, but more importantly, rich, powerful people protect people.
And that's ruling class solidarity.
It's true, and it's true, you know. So you can search a lot for these little individual links, which often do have significance, but they're not the reason. Like, why? You know, Jeffrey Epstein didn't get a sweetheart deal because just because he knew people in the Justice Department. He knew people in the Justice Department because he was a rich guy. And that's why he got a sweetheart deal.
Well, that's the other important part of the story, right? I mean, this is the story of how wealth and social capital is used to avoid justice and to just leverage yourself. I mean, that's what it comes down to for me. All the other stuff, whether we're talking about a blackmail operation, whether we're talking about intel stuff, whether we're talking about international trafficking, you know, this is the story of a society in which a man like this was able to get away with all of this for the longest time because of his social capital and his economic capital as well.
Right. Of course. And that's what all aspects lead back to that. Mm-hmm. Rich people get away with anything.
Well, hey, Marlon, we'll have to have you back on in the future. I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. Maybe you can tell my listeners how they can follow your work. I know you've written for some different outlets. You've had some stuff in Counterpunch. We've had a lot of guests from Counterpunch on and Splinter News. So how can they keep up with you, Marlon?
I didn't actually write anything for Splinter. I was in an article. Usually you could keep up with me through Twitter, but my account got suspended recently. So there's actually no way right now. But if I get that account unsuspended, you could follow me on Twitter. That's MARLON. And then Ettinger, Ettinger.
Okay, and I have stopped recording.
Cool.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. Expect a few more upcoming episodes on the Epstein case. I'm trying to talk to Roberta Glass from True Crime Report, who also was looking at the court case in New York. Pierce Redmond is hopefully going to be coming on soon. Possibly Whitney Webb. I'm contacting as many people as I can. I really think this is, you know, the time to cover this more than ever. I mean, I've been covering it for a year, but this whole thing has exploded. So expect more. Not much more I can say other than that. Please support the Parallax Views Patreon. I really, really appreciate anyone who's supporting Parallax Views at this point, though. I can't say it enough. Thank you so much. Also, be sure to check out the True Anon podcast and Twitter. That's Brace Belden and a few others. I know Dasha from Red Scare is helping out with that. So check out True Anon. They're covering the Epstein case. Be sure to check out Ed Opperman, the private investigator who's been covering this probably longer than anyone, including myself. Also, keep up with Porkin's Policy Review, Pierce Redmond. Also, the Antifada. Check out the Antifada. I'm going to be collaborating with them soon on an episode about Operation Gladio. So there's that. I think I should be doing a show not related to Epstein, but a show with the Horror Vanguard soon, who cover horror movies from sort of a left-wing political perspective. So I'm really busy lately. But I appreciate everyone who has been listening, and like I said, especially Patreon subscribers. And of course, real big thanks to Marlon Ettinger. Check him out on Facebook. There's some issues with his Twitter right now, but I'm sure he'll be back on Twitter eventually. Check him out on Facebook, Marlon Ettinger. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.